welcome to this week's episode of Aquadocs, the podcast that keeps you up to date on all things aquatic medicine. I'm your host, Michelle Greenfield. This week, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Sarah Keenly, assistant professor at Baylor. On this episode, we highlight some of Dr. Keenly's pinniped research in Antarctica. And I don't know about you, but I get pretty jazzed when I hear about cool research happening in remote places like Antarctica. So I really hope you enjoy this episode. Let's just jump right in. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to Aquadocs.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really nice to talk to you.
It's great to have you here. And I'm super excited to talk about some of the work that you do, especially in the extremities of this planet. But before we get there, can you share with our listeners a story that helped shape where you are today?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have that quintessential story of I saw a dolphin. It was in sixth grade. I grew up in Austin, Texas, which is landlocked. And we went on a field trip in middle school to the coast. And I was with my best friend, who's still my best friend today. And we were on this jetty and we made up this song to call over a dolphin. It went to the tune of head, shoulders, knees, and toes. And it went something like beak, dorsal fin, back and tail, back and tail. And I kid you not, a bottlenose dolphin came over. My best friend and I were ecstatic. It then swam off, and we spent the next 30 minutes singing that song obsessively, hoping it would come back. It did not. But just that trip to the coast was so magical and inspiring that that formed exactly what I went into in the future, which was play with dolphins, which I do absolutely none of these days.
I love that. That I think is the first time I've gotten someone to sing on this podcast. So thank you so much for that.
Yeah, you're so welcome. I'm known for my really stellar singing voice too. So I'm so glad it's going to go to a really wide audience.
Yeah, you know, there might be some producers listening.
A talent scouts who can contact me should they wish me to sing more.
Truly. Thank you. Okay. So if you don't study dolphins, and that was this formative moment in your early career in marine biology and marine mammal science, can you tell our listeners a little bit about what you're doing now?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a marine mammal researcher. The bulk of my work has been with pinnipeds and looking at foraging behavior, dive behavior, what are they doing when they're at sea and how is this affecting their ability to survive and reproduce and adapt to changing environments? And then my work more recently is expanding to also include whales, potentially some dolphins as well, and looking at the variety of really amazing adaptations these animals have for life in the ocean, as well as how marine mammals serve as sentinel species for ocean health as a whole.
And I think that's a really cool point that you spend a lot of time studying, which is the sentinel for ocean health. I'd love to dive a little deeper there. What are some of the things that you're finding that can then directly relate to this bigger topic of ocean health?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the really interesting things about marine mammals is that they do not follow any sort of country state boundaries. They are moving and traveling throughout huge ocean basins. And a lot of the species I study travel widely. One of the reasons marine mammals are such great sentinel species is because they are often top predators. So at the very top of ocean food webs. So if you see changes at the top in the abundance or the distribution where these animals are found, that is telling you that everything else is changing lower down on that food web as well. So one of the interesting things about these groups is that it's really hard to study marine mammals in general, especially when you're wanting to know a lot more about their life history, where animals that travel large distances go, animals that spend most of their time underwater, often in remote habitats that are difficult to access as humans. It can be really, really challenging to get really basic data for these species, like what do they eat? Which is a pretty fundamental question if you want to understand what an animal is doing and where they fit in a food chain and how they're going to be affected by climate change and human activities. And so a lot of my work is trying to get this basic baseline data on these really important animals who we can't watch doing really basic behaviors like eating. And so coming up with some really creative tools to estimate what they're doing when they're at sea to better understand the species as a whole and then their role in ocean ecosystems.
So I know that when I'm doing a necropsy, which is an animal autopsy, one of the things that I'm looking for is going into the stomach and seeing what are its prey contents? What is it eating? But I know that you're not doing necropsies all the time. So what are some of these ways that you're estimating and able to figure out what it is these animals are eating?
That's a great question. So one of the ways that we do this is we can put instruments called biologgers on animals that will record what that animal is doing when they're at sea. These instruments can have a variety of things they measure, but at the core, usually the ones that I work with track their location. A lot of them will also have what's called a time depth recorder attached to it, which allows you to measure how deep animals are diving. So you can look at dive behavior. And then the group that I do a lot of work with, pinnipeds, when we are putting these instruments on, we're also able to take all sorts of samples. And samples can mean things like hair, whiskers, blood samples. And from those, you can get an absurd amount of information, including information on diet. So for any animal, you could take any sort of tissue sample. So imagine taking a piece of your hair right now, and we can do what's called stable isotope analysis on that hair. We can cut it up into little segments, analyze it for different elements. So like carbon and nitrogen, for example, that give you a sense of what that animal is eating. It's not going to tell you that I had a breakfast taco earlier, but it will tell you whether or not I'm a vegetarian or more of an omnivore, or whether I lean more toward carnivorous. So it's going to give you a sense of where an animal is on a trophic scale. And then there also are ways to start getting more species level diet information as well. So it's this really cool technique for taking these tissues and being able to estimate diet and trophic position without actually having to watch what an animal is doing, because often these animals are hundreds to thousands of meters under the water where it is completely dark. And so you're not seeing what they're eating. And so this is a creative way to be able to get at that same information.
Yeah, amazing, super creative. And it's incredible that you're able to find such information. I know they're going down to deep depths, but have you ever been able to put like a GoPro type thing on them to compare what your data is to what you're able to see?
There are different types of video tags that you can attach to animals. And they have done this in a variety of species, including whales, pinnipeds, and you can get exactly what you're talking about, video data from the animal's perspective of what they are doing. There are a lot of caveats associated with that in terms of you have to have an animal you're going to be able to get that instrument back from, because one of the things about video data and any sort of photograph data is it's really giant in terms of how much data it's producing. And so it cannot transmit through the satellite system. So you actually have to physically retrieve that camera to get any data. And some of the work I've done with leopard seals in Antarctica, the individuals we were working on, we never saw again. And so we kind of knew that ahead of time. So putting video loggers on them would not have been useful, because this amazing data would never have been retrieved. But there are other species where you can get those instruments back and get this really powerful data. It's usually for a short period of time though, because again, there's so much data that it uses up the battery really quickly. And so a lot of times it's hours to maybe weeks. You have to imagine it as a very small snapshot of time in an animal's life. But again, how cool is it that you can watch from an animal's perspective what they are doing in the water and what they're eating?
Yeah, it's some of the coolest footage I've ever seen. When I was working down at Sandcob in South Africa with wild penguins, one of the researchers there had put a video tag on one of the birds, and it's unbelievable to really see bird's eye what they're doing. So super cool, but that's not the focus of what you do. So you mentioned that you're down in Antarctica and you're collecting these samples from the animals. Can you talk us through what that process is like?
Yeah, absolutely. And I should first preface this by saying, do not do this at home. Do not approach wild animals. That is a terrible idea. They're wild. They can hurt you. You can hurt them. Stay away, give them space. And so any of the work I do is never just one person. It's always a whole team of very experienced and trained professionals. And we have extensive permits. So with all of that kind of backstory, the way we work is we're working with seals and sea lions. The animals are on the beach. So they are hauled out, which means they have kind of come out of the water onto land, usually to sleep. For leopard seals, as an Antarctic predator, a lot of time they're spending in the water, they're eating. And the ones that we were working with came out to sleep off like a giant meal. They would basically come out, sleep, poop, and then go back to sea to feed. So the way it works is they're asleep. They are snoring. So I don't know if you know this, but seals snore. We will sneak up and we have a pole with a really long syringe in it that has a chemical sedative in it that puts them to sleep for a short period of time. And we're using kind of the same needles you would use on humans. They will wake up, look around, we back off, and then they just fall back asleep. and you will hear them snoring again. And then that usually takes about 15 to 20 minutes before they're fully asleep and then sedated. And then we can safely approach. And this is all for the safety of both the animal and then our team. You would never want to work with an animal when they're completely awake. They are very bitey, as they should be. And so once the animal is down, we can take all sorts of measurements and samples that you just would never be able to get any other way. We'll take girth, so how fat they are. We'll take all the tissue samples I'd mentioned before. We'll take mass, and then we'll attach an instrument to them. One of the really interesting things about seals and sea lions is that they go through a molt every year where they will shed their skin and hair. So the longest any instrument could ever stay on an animal would be at most a year. And then it'll literally fall off as this kind of like little package on the beach. And so we put these devices on, but they're not going to be for the long term. It'll give you months worth of data, and then eventually will either be retrieved by a scientist or will fall off on the beach. And then usually we'll work as quickly as possible. And then the animal will wake up, and then we watch the animal until they are completely mobile, moving around, behaving normally before we will leave, because we want to make sure that that animal is as safe and back to normal before we ever completely depart from that area.
Oh, it sounds like an incredible thing. Though I have to ask, you mentioned mass. Some of the animals I know can be quite heavy. So how are you able to get those weights?
Yeah. So to measure mass, we have a three-part setup. So we have a large canvas sling that has metal poles on either end that will actually roll the animal onto. So you need a team, because you actually need multiple people to be able to push the seal and roll them onto the sling. Then we have a winch that's attached to a tripod, and we literally have a hand crank to lift them up. And you're only needing to lift the seal maybe like 1 inch above the ground, but you need every part of their body not touching so that you're getting an accurate mass. And then we'll lower them back down, roll them off the sling before they wake up. And mass is such an important measurement because it really gives you a sense of body condition. So you can take an animal's full length and their mass, and you can get these estimates of body condition, how fat versus thin they are for their length. And that's a really important metric for health in understanding differences among sexes and age classes, and even among different populations and regions. And so if you can get that data, that's one of my favorite ones to get, because it links to so many other ecological and physiological parameters for these animals.
Gotcha. I was particularly interested in that because I just finished the dolphin necropsy earlier today, and our dolphin was about 250 pounds. And there were three of us there trying to hoist this thing in a similar thing you just described in a stretcher and then hoisting it up. It's challenging. And I can only imagine you're wearing multiple layers out on the Antarctic ice. Like, you got a good team with you, I'm sure.
And I'm particularly wary now of the hand crank, because doing some elephant seal work many years ago, we just had a fluke thing happen where one of the carabiners that's involved in helping the lifting process broke and smashed me in the forehead. This is all captured on national television. You can actually watch the Jeff Corwin show, and you can see me crumple after it smashes me in the forehead. I was fine. Everybody was fine. It was just complete luck and a complete accident.
Was this Ocean Mysteries?
Uh-huh. It's on Elephant Seal Ocean Mysteries. There's an elephant seal episode. And I'm actually a commercial break. It goes, will the equipment hold? And the answer is yes, the equipment always holds. The equipment never breaks. But then it goes dark and you hear it go, crack, ah! And that's me. And then it like goes to commercial.
Oh my gosh. I used to spend every Saturday morning watching Jeff Corn Ocean Mysteries and then going to Sam Champion on Sea Rescue. That's fantastic. Wow. I will 100% be rewatching that and look out for that commercial break. Oh my gosh. That's so funny.
What a random thing. Like the carabiner broke. That doesn't happen. It snapped in two places. And like the seal was totally fine. Like she wasn't even off the ground yet. So like she didn't even fall. It was just the pressure shifted.
Wow. What a great story. So I kind of want to talk about some of your experiences working in Antarctica, because I know that can be challenging. You only have a couple months of the year to go down there, how you get down there, where you're living, all of that stuff. Can you give a little play-by-play of what happens and how you do research down there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I will say that we were a weird Antarctic trip in general. So a lot of times when you hear people talk about doing research in Antarctica, especially if it's in the United States, it's either boat-based or station-based. And one of the big stations, like if you're imagining Antarctica, you're probably picturing penguins, really cold, icy winds, lots of ice. McMurdo is the really big research station for Antarctica. We did not go there. We went to this tiny research hut on this island called Livingston Island. If you imagine Antarctica, there's a little arm that comes up that's the Antarctic Peninsula. And then off of that arm, there's a little island chain. And so one of those islands is where we went. So McMurdo is essentially a little city. There are cooks, there are bars, there are hot tubs, there is running water, there's electricity. We did not experience that where we went. So the way we get to where we went is our research team flew to Punta Arenas, Chile, which is the southern tip of Chile. We got on one of the National Science Foundation research vessels. It was like about 3 to 5 days, depending on the particular trip. We would take that boat, cross the roughest seas in the world, the Drake's Passage, going down to Antarctica. And then we would get dropped off. There were 5 of us. And then the boat would leave and we would be the only people on this island. And help was about 24 hours away by boat. One field season, we were there for about 3.5 weeks. And that was in 2018. And then in 2019, we went again to the same place and we were there for about 5 weeks. And then at the end of that time, the boat would come back, pick us up. We would cross those really rough seas again, make it back to Punta Arenas, Chile. And then we would fly back to the United States, back to our home. And then while we were on the island itself, NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, has a long-term research station there, as does Chile's Antarctic program. The two buildings are very, very close. And so it's these wooden huts. There's a generator for heat and also our electricity. There is no running water. So there's these giant gallon bins. That also means there's no flushing for toilets. So we had an outhouse and there was a bucket for number one and a bucket for number two. And we had a kitchen with every spice you can imagine. Actually, the kitchen was incredibly well stocked. We had a cold room and we had some freezers that were generator backup that we kept our food cold and we had dry foods. And we lived there in bunk beds, in a really small, like one room cabin, with very, very little privacy. And we would spend most of our days walking around the island looking for leopard seals.
Wow. Sounds like you got really close to your colleagues.
Physically and emotionally, yes, we were very close. We also had no connection to the outside world other than a satellite phone. And if you're not familiar with satellite phones, there is no texting, there's no internet. It's just you were calling and hoping the satellites are working. And the most I think we got was like a 27-minute call without it dropping, and you would go into a different hut that didn't have the heater and you would sit in your giant parka and call loved ones once a day to check in. And then depending on how many times the call dropped, you'd be like, all right, I love you. I'll talk to you later. Those calls were our only source of information from the outside world. And it just was shocking how quickly that just became normal. Like, oh, we would just report everything we learned to each other and just told our life stories. We watched movies, we read books. We would talk about all of that because what else was there to do? It was a very interesting, unique bonding experience.
No, it sounds great. And what a unique opportunity. And so then you're out looking for the seals. So what were some of your goals going in and how did that change as you were there? And then just generally, what do you think a good sample size is for a study like that?
Yeah, those are all really good questions. So one of the really tricky things about this project and any project, especially with leopard seals, is that they're really solitary animals and we don't know very much about them. So they're these top predators. They're equivalent to killer whales in the Southern Ocean and around Antarctica. They eat other seals. They eat seabirds and penguins. They also eat fish and krill. And so they're really important predators, but we know very little about them. And they're solitary, meaning you don't see them hauling out in large groups like other species do. And so there's not a lot of research on them because it's really hard to get funding to go study a species that you don't know that you're going to be able to find. So we were very successful in getting funding and we were hoping to basically be able to sample and instrument 10 animals per season over a 3-year grant. COVID got in the way of that. So we ended up with 22 samples at the end of the full study, which was amazing. That's one of the largest sample sizes ever for this species, but we were hoping for 10 and that would have been amazing. when we went down to Antarctica, we were actually going April to May, which sounds lovely if you're in the Northern Hemisphere. But if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, it's flipped. And that's literally fall going into winter, which is a terrible time to be going to Antarctica. Nobody had really been on this island during that time. So we had no idea whether we were going to find any leopard seals. But the option kind of came down to, like, you can go now or not. And we chose, let's go and see what happens. And so we did end up, one season we got 12 animals and one season we got 10. And so we were thrilled to get that sample size. And it was not obvious that that was going to be easy, because some days we would see nothing. We would see no leopard seals whatsoever. Other days we might see a maximum of 2. And when I say these guys are solitary, it's shocking, because I've also worked with other species that are laying on top of each other in hundreds and hundreds of animals. Leopard seals, we would see one hauled out on a beach, and you might see one swimming around, and it would look. And if it saw a leopard seal hauled out, it would disappear and we would never see it again. It was like, oh, this island's already ruined. I'm going somewhere else. I think the longest we went was like, we went an entire week without seeing a leopard seal. And I don't know if you can imagine how antsy a group of scientists can get when they're to study leopard seals and you haven't seen your study species in a week and you only have 4 weeks total. We were getting really nervous every day, like the tension built up, like, please let somebody find a leopard seal that we can work with.
Wow. I don't envy that week, but the rest of the time, I really envy it. Sounds great. Now that we know what they eat and where they are and when you're seeing them, how do we then get a better picture of overall ocean health?
Well, so when I think about ocean health, that means a lot of different things to me. And one of the things for ocean health is protecting the animals that live there and call it home and are so important for structuring the ecosystem. And one of the things about leopard seals is I've mentioned that they're very poorly studied, and where they live is one of the biodiversity hotspots for Antarctica. And what that means is that there are a lot of species that really depend on this area. And so that means you get really high species diversity in the Antarctic Peninsula. And leopard seals are one of the really important components of that. But because they're so poorly studied, people have tried to make marine protected areas for that area. But leopard seals have not been included in the design of marine protected areas in the past, including in the Western Antarctic Peninsula, where they're a really important predator. So I'm so excited, because one of the things we did was track leopard seals and their movement patterns around this area and showed that the Western Antarctic Peninsula is really important for leopard seals. Some of them spent pretty much their entire tracking period in that small area, and others traveled much more wildly. So in our study, we had one individual travel only 46 kilometers during the entire time that she was tracked. Another one traveled 1700 kilometers in about that same 5 month period. And so just showcasing that variability is really important when trying to design protected areas that are going to really overlap with how animals are using space. And so really excited for that data to be included moving forward in future marine protected area proposals. One of the things I'm really excited to work on next is we have this small data set from this one population over this 2 year period. And I want to know, how representative is that of the species as a whole? So leopard seals are interesting because they are also now being documented regularly in South America and New Zealand. So areas that are very decidedly not Antarctica. And there are a number of researchers, including myself, who are really interested in, like, what does this mean? Are animals being pushed out of Antarctica because of climate change, rapid warming, melting sea ice, and having to move to these new areas? Are they doing really well, and so they're able to expand their population? Have they historically been in these areas and just not well documented? But thinking about ocean health, if you have an apex predator moving to new areas, that's really important, because I mentioned before that their changes in their numbers at the top of a food chain is going to dramatically change the rest of the ecosystem. Imagine having a top predator moving somewhere it's never been before, but being very good at eating things. That's what's happening with leopard seals in these new areas, is that they're going to be a really important part of that ecosystem. We don't know what they're eating. We don't know what food sources they're targeting. And so understanding the species level behaviors as a whole is going to be really critical to understanding what's their effect going to be in these areas, as well as, is this species one that's going to be threatened by climate change? Or do they have a lot of flexibility that's going to make them pretty able to adapt to a really changing environment? Because you have species on both sides of the spectrum, right? You have ones that are going to be losers under climate change that just are really specialized, are going to have a really hard time adapting to a really changing environment. And you have others that are going to be winners that are really flexible and can adapt to these changes. My gut right now, and the data suggests that leopard seals are going to be on that winner's side, that they seem to be very flexible. And that data is only from a small population though. So that's why I'm really excited to expand this more broadly to understand what we might expect to see from leopard seals moving forward, and how that's going to affect ocean health and other ocean ecosystems around the Southern Ocean.
Well, Sarah, this has been fantastic. I have learned so much today. But before we close out, I would love if you could share with our listeners some advice, especially for some of our students. I feel like oftentimes we talk a lot about the veterinary side of things, but you have a lot of graduate students in your lab. So for those who might be looking to a master's or a PhD, what advice do you have for them?
Great question. So in terms of big advice I have is start getting experience doing research. This applies not just for people interested in graduate school, but also if you're interested in doing veterinary medicine, but whatever it is that you envision that you want to do with your life, start getting experience in it and like testing it out, right? Like you're trying on a career, if you want to imagine that way. Volunteer if you're able to and have the financial means to be able to volunteer. Find a paid internship, but start trying to do the thing that you think is what you want to do with the rest of your life. Because what it turns out is like you may have nailed it and know exactly what you want to do. And that's a perfect fit. If that's you, great. Congratulations. You did it. Keep going. But it also might be that you try it and you decide like, oh, this is not what I thought it was going to be. And I need to pivot. Or there's this other aspect that I want to explore. And that's what college is so magical for, is that you get to try a lot of different things. And I'm a marine mammal person. I grew up in Austin, Texas, which is landlocked. There aren't pinnipeds in the Gulf of Mexico, but I work with these amazing species now. And part of that was that I had this amazing dolphin experience as a sixth grader, but also I tried a lot of different things before getting to where I am today. I did research in caves in New Mexico. It was awesome. I decided I didn't really want to study bacteria, too small, also too landlocked. I did an internship in South Carolina working with amphipods. Imagine like doodle bugs or pill bugs of the sea. That's what they kind of look like. Loved the ocean environment and doing research. Didn't really love the like tiny herbivores eating seaweed. And so all of those experiences were so formative that it wasn't the perfect fit, but it led me to figuring out what it was I loved. I also was a middle school and high school teacher for 3 years in between undergrad and grad school. And found out I love teaching. Did not know that before doing that. I had envisioned more of just a straight research track. And then that changed my career trajectory. I decided I wanted to do this combination of research and teaching, which is what I'm doing today. And I absolutely love it. But there's been all of these different steps along the way that have been so helpful for me in figuring out what it is I wanted to do. And so try things on because you don't know exactly what's going to be a good fit. And there's no one straight path. So that's my like biggest advice is like, just try things out. And it's really hard to put yourself out there in terms of contacting a professor or contacting somebody that you want to intern for. But who's going to say, how dare you contact me about thinking my job is cool, right? Like that's not going to happen because you would be a real jerk if that was your response to somebody like reaching out to you for advice or for a position. And like the worst thing they're going to do is say no, like I don't have space or no, thank you for your interest. And you just reach out to somebody else. There's a lot of persistence, but like if you really want to do something, find a way to try and make that happen. And it may take a longer period of time than you think. That's fine. It's not a linear path. It takes as long as it takes. And just keep figuring out what makes you happy at this given time in your life, because you're the only one that can like figure out what's best for you.
Dr. Keenly, thank you so much for sharing all of your stories and pinniped wisdom with us today.
Oh, you're so welcome.
And that's going to do it for this week's episode of Aquadocs. I'd like to thank Dr. Sarah Keenly for being on the show this week, our sponsors WAVMA and AFE, as well as all of you, our wonderful listeners, for tuning in. As always, check out our Facebook and Instagram to stay up to date on the latest Aquadocs news. And if you got an extra moment, please rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and leave a review. I'm Michelle Greenfield. Stay healthy, stay safe, and we'll see you next time here on Aquadocs.